Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Right, well, since we're recording, have we said enough rubbish for Paul to filter something out of this?
Sometimes I don't put anything in.
So, wait a minute. Our subject is Mavericks. What exactly does Maverick mean?
It's in the intro, Paddy, so as usual I say, shut up and listen, and then you can speak.
Okay. Just one quick word on Mavericks. I used to watch a Western series on the telly.
It's in the introduction, Paddy!
Spoiler! Spoiler! James Garner.
Oh, right. Will you all... Can
hush
you
up.
All let
hush
me just...
Up.
Right. Hello, everyone. This is Colin Schindler, along with John Holmes and Patrick Barclay, welcoming you back to another edition of Football Ruin My Life. And this week, we're going to be talking about The Maverick. No, not the old TV series first transmitted in 1957, in which James Garner played Brett Maverick, an adroitly articulate poker player plying his trade on riverboats and in saloons while travelling through the 19th century American frontier. In fact, the dictionary definition of a maverick is an unorthodox or independent-minded person, which pretty much sums up the players we think of as mavericks. Stan Bowles, Frank Worthington, Charlie George, Tony Curry, Rodney Marsh, to name but five. Were there others? Then it occurs to me that, of course, they were all playing at the end of the 1960s and throughout the 1970s. Now, that's a bit weird. Why were there so many Mavericks then? Were there none before and none since? Surely not. I have my own theory about this, and I strongly suspect I'm about to speak to two men who have their own explanation for this phenomenon. Paddy, could you and your team of valuable researchers, lately diminished, I understand, by economic circumstances, provide us with some sort of an insight into the Mavericks?
I call it Wikipedia. But yes, I don't want to preempt your theory, but I'd like to throw in Jim Baxter.
Oh, yes,
who was a hell of a Maverick. There were Mavericks, of course, before, starting with the tragic Maverick, Hughie Gallagher, who came down from Scotland and played for, well, notably Newcastle, but I think Chelsea and others, and was a tragic Maverick. He ended up taking his own life after a family incident, but one of the best players in the world at that time. He was certainly a Maverick. He played the game exactly the way he wanted to. So there were lots and lots of them, but the thing that I would say is that there aren't any now. If you ask us to name Mavericks in the modern game, there probably won't be any. And I wonder if that's linked to the fact that the drinking culture, the carefree culture. I mean, it's not fashionable to be carefree anymore.
Wouldn't you think that Cristiano Ronaldo would qualify as a maverick?
That's a good question.
An egomaniac, certainly.
Well, yes. Well, maybe the two go together, because my other point was, Paddy was saying very nice things about the Mavericks that I mentioned. But at the same time, I would imagine, John, that most of the managers who manage those Mavericks would not have had the same response.
They probably wouldn't. I mean, we didn't mention Len Shackleton, who was certainly a man who went his own way and who infamously had a chapter in his autobiography entitled The Average Football Director's Knowledge of Football and left it blank page. I've got a copy of that book.
Clown Prince of Soccer by Len Shackleton.
The Clown Shackleton. Prince of Soccer, that's correct. Played up in the northeast and started at Bradford. I think he started at Bradford Park
Avenue.
Yes,
he did, yeah.
I think probably what has happened now is it's all much more professional. George Best, obviously, I mean, he's the greatest maverick of all, probably. Yes. These were players who flourished outside the coaching system or the coaching manuals. And for managers at that point, it was very difficult for them to handle these people, not only because they just went their own way on the pitch, sometimes they went their own way off the pitch. I knew Frank Worthington pretty well. I saw him, first of all, I was at University at Leeds. I was University Digs in South Leeds, not far from Elland Road, but it was a very easy trip down the road to Huddersfield, to Leeds Road, and to watch the Huddersfield side that reached the First Division at that point under Ian Greaves. And the young star of that side was Frank Worthington, who did knock about in the night spots of Leeds. Frank was one of three brothers, and according to a friend of mine, they were all mad. They came from Shelf near Halifax. Bob played for Notts County and Dave played for Grimsby. But Frank, I suspect, was the maddest of all, and he played up front. He had long hair. He didn't have a terrific work rate, Frank, but he had terrific skill. He got called up in the summer of 1972 to join the England squad. He arrived in cowboy boots, a cowboy hat, and a big belt with Elvis written on it. Alf was somewhat taken aback, shall we say. Oh, hello, Frank.
That's in a very good biography of Alf by Leo McKinstry, which delineates that scene precisely as you've described it. Alf, at that point, 72, this is the time when Gunter Netzer and Germany ran him ragged. It's as if his time had expired at that point, when he's calling up players like that with whom he has no real connection. Whereas if you go back to Roger Hunt and you go back to Nobby Stiles and you go back to Ray Wilson, they're the reverse of Mavericks. They were whatever else.
They all had sensible haircuts, didn't they?
All of that. And I do, and I think it's got something to do, and this is my explanation, with national service. Because I think all those players did national service. And Jimmy Armfield and the corporal or sergeant in charge told them what to do. And they just got on with it and did it. Why would you not? And I think by the time we get to Frank Worthington and Stan Bowles and Charlie George, authority, such as it was a thing to be thumbed your nose at. I mean, Paddy, you're grinning, but I'm not sure whether you're grinning in agreement or in disbelief.
No, I'm grinning in enlightenment, actually, but also kind of laughing at the idea of Colin Schindler being the sort of blimpish type who would say, I tell you what, these chaps need a jolly good spell in the army.
War starts at midnight. Yes, fine, absolutely. I'll start.
Now, it all started between the Lady Chatterley Band and the
Beatles'
first
LP.
But I mean, you know, I suddenly feel that I've learned what the difference was, Colin. Yeah, the start of the age of cock in a snook, you know.
There was no me age in the team that went to Chile in 62 or the team
I suppose you could. I'd written down the name of Johnny Haynes. Was he a maverick? He wasn't unorthodox. He was just brilliant, a great through passer and great player. But he was independent-minded in that he had no sense of his teammates' feelings. Famously, you know, if a pass was too good for Jimmy
Toss
Hill
Chamberlain,
Chamberlain, and they didn't see it, he'd stare them out with his hands on his hips. I don't suppose that really qualifies him.
No, I don't. See, what does unite those players is one has a feeling, and John can come in and tell me I'm wrong, is that they never really fulfilled their, you know, they were all very skillful, but certainly in international terms, none of them made an impact of any significance commensurate with their ability. John, what do you think about that?
I think that's possibly right. Certainly, I think with Frank's dead now. Frank died 2 or 3 years back, rather sad. He had dementia towards the end. In Frank's case, I think he was one of these who really underlyingly was very insecure. I don't think he wanted to put himself to the ultimate test because he feared he might fail it. And it was difficult to coach these players with their insecurities. Certainly Frank had them. Jimmy Bloomfield did a hell of a job with Frank. Frank missed training. Frank was all over the place in many ways. As a person, he had a stormy relationship with his wife. he wasn't a big drinker, but he liked, you know, the high life. He liked staying out late at night. He liked wearing clothes that were not typical of players at that stage. You know, you talk about that era of Maverick. Who was the first long-haired player you saw? The players of our youth, they either resembled Paddy, no hair at all, or they had comb-overs, or they had, like Colin, you know, they had proper haircuts, Colin. He's got a proper haircut.
I go to the same man to cut my hair since November 1972. The same person has been cutting my hair.
That does not come as a massive surprise to me, Colin. And you worked at university, you see. You did not have scruffy long hair at university, whereas I did, and all photographs of my graduation were destroyed by my mother, but that's another matter.
For me, growing hair was always a waste of hormones. But, I mean, I think if you look at a lot of these players, they were long-haired. I met Frank Worthington once. I did quite a deep interview with him when he was at Bolton. And, my God, what an Indian summer that was, that wonderful team, including Willie Morgan, Tony Dunn, both fantastic players. Dunn, one of the best fullbacks I ever saw in my life. But he was the star, and I got the impression, interviewing him, that he was a serious man about football. You know, he could wear cowboy boots, he could worship Elvis, he could do this, do that. But he was very, very serious about what he did, which was entertain. And I think Alan Hudson, who I also
met. Yes, I was thinking
he was serious. Alan Hudson is the one that you can't see the flaws in, because he could get around the field. He didn't have a lack of pace like Curry. He didn't have a lack of stamina like Osgood. He didn't have a lack of seriousness like Stan Bowles. And perhaps that inner security that you've identified in Frank Worthington. Although Frank, to me, was reincarnated in Dimitar Berbatov. That languid ability to balance for a reasonably big man and that deceptively languid style. But Worthington, I remember... You know, everyone remembers the goal for Leicester against Ipswich.
Is that the over-the-head and turn-around and
over the head, turn.
That was for Bolton.
Sorry. Yes, I thought it was Bolton.
It was for Bolton. You're quite right. Anyway, whatever. If you look at the defenders who push out and get fooled, they're Terry Butcher, Russell Osman, Mick Mills. It's like the England defence that he's taking the piss out of.
I can remember him playing for Leicester, chipping Liam McFall from way out.
Yeah.
Who's the Newcastle goalkeeper. Mm. I can also remember Frank Worthington punching one into the net.
Yes.
Leicester against Coventry.
Yep.
It was given. The goal stood. Yes. Yep. He ran back to the halfway line, apparently shouting at his teammates, handball, handball. Yeah. And the Coventry players were purple with rage.
Yes, of course.
But he got away with that. On his day, he had tremendous skill. But it wasn't every day, you know. There were days when Frank would not perform. I watched him a lot. Leicester had some real flair players at that stage. They had Keith Weller. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether you describe Keith Weller as a maverick, because he didn't have long hair. Mm-hmm. But Keith was, in his own way, a maverick player. Great dribbler from that era. When Revy became England manager, wanted to build the England team around him, but that was a short-lived experiment. Alf didn't play Keith Weller, did he?
No, well, that was the point in 1974 when Alf went, I think, in April, May. And then Don Revy took over, having, you know, coached the Leeds side to the heights of almost perfection in that 73-74 season. We didn't take over till the beginning of the next season. After Ramsey had been sacked, there was a tour that summer, and they appointed Joe Mercer as caretaker manager. Now, as I remember, he went straight for Stan Bowles because he'd been the manager at City. When
and Frank Bowles, Worthington.
He seemed to embrace those flair players in a way that Alf never did. And, you know, I'm not sure that Don Revy did for any length of time.
Don Revy promoted Alan Hudson with instant success, as I recall. It was a wonderful 2-0 win at Wembley. I can't even remember who it was.
But they didn't go. Those players didn't go on
and
dominate England football as you feel should have.
I think playing for England would have bored them stiff.
Why?
Well, how many good performances does the national team provide, you know? I mean, yes, the team that ended up beating Scotland 9-3 and beating everybody else 8-0 and all that, the Haynes, Charlton. Yeah. Bobby Smith,
Greaves
and Brian Douglas. That team had flair and it was brilliant every day. But great, really vibrant England performances aren't very frequent. National teams actually don't often play well. And I think these guys were more suited to club football.
We didn't qualify for the World Cup during that period, of course.
Yes, and that's true. But in club football, all of those guys, the team would be built around them and would be designed to accommodate them. Some teams, you know, Stoke City under Waddington and so on, and Bloomfield's Leicester, there were teams that had 3 to 4 flair-ish players. But basically, that would be it. Whereas at England, they were asked to do a job. That's why Letizier, another Maverick, never really made it as an international player. Because these guys are not put on this earth to do a job, to fit in like Roger Hunt or even Aaron Ball. The England team that won the World Cup, there wasn't a flair player in that team.
There were great players.
There were two great players, but Charlton and Moore.
And Banks.
You could include Banks, but goalkeepers don't have flair, do they?
Did you never see Ramon Quiroga, the man who did the scorpion kick?
Did he ever do it again?
No, he was an outfield player. Like a lot of these goals, outfield player. I mean, Frank Swift was a flair player who played in goal. I'd have loved to have seen him. He seems to have had a lot of flair. But anyway, we digress. Charlton, whatever else he was, and he was a great player. He was a world-class player for 10 years. There's no question about that. But he wasn't a maverick, was he?
No, but I would prefer to have Charlton the way he was than a maverick who turned it on once in a while.
Exactly.
And that is the point. I mean, all those players I nominated, including the ones that we've now added, Alan Hudson, none of them seemed to have the careers that their talent warranted. You know, Stan Bowles, when Stan Bowles left QPR when he was happy, I think, and went to Forest. I mean, you know, John will know more than I do, but he had a miserable time at Forest. Why did Clough sign him? And what happened when he got there, John?
Clough wanted power over people. Therefore, he liked to think that he could control these people. He'd controlled Kenny Burns. He'd controlled Larry Lloyd. And he'd made a player out of John Robertson, who was a flair player. I think Clough had this ego thing. But of course, Bowles was destroyed by gambling. And Peter Shilton in it, Christ. No wonder bookmakers did well in Nottingham at that stage. There are stories about branches of Ladbrokes where the managers got promoted as a result of that tie.
The team didn't get promoted, but the managers of the bookies did.
What Paddy says is interesting. A club side, you can perhaps build around one or two players. At international level, it didn't tend to happen, did it?
No.
Because you got a lot of good players, very, very good players, brilliant players, and you've got to control the egos of all these brilliant players. In this country, we didn't build our international sides around one or two players.
Yes.
Now, Paul has pointed out, the Dutch were built around Cruyff. That is the personality of Cruyff. Maradona won the World Cup, did he not?
Platini.
That you are talking about the best players in the world. Yeah, Platini would be another one. The recent example would, of course, be Messi. Eric Cantona, the ultimate maverick. Mm-hmm. Manchester United didn't win anything, did they, till he went there?
That's right.
He was a catalyst.
And Ferguson, who was one of the ultimate control freaks about a team, he managed to control Cantona, up to a point.
Up to a point, yes.
He lost it when he jumped into the crowd at Crystal Palace.
Yep.
So it's very difficult. Only the greatest managers can perhaps harness somebody like Cantona. And only the greatest players can win at international level. That's not to say with the Dutch side, of course. There weren't other very, very good players. And Johnny Rep, for instance, who was the guy who scored a lot of goals for the Netherlands, he actually regarded Cruyff is a pain in the arse, and went on saying so.
At the time, you talk about club teams being built around a player. Although the France team that won the European Championship in 1984, Platini scored 9 goals in 5 games in that tournament and dominated a continent, really. Although it was a 4-man midfield, Tigana, Gires, Platini, Fernandes. But Platini was obviously outstanding. During that period, I was of the belief that England should do that with Glenn Hoddle. He was a maverick in a footballing sense in that he believed he knew more about football than anybody else. And he was entitled to do that because of his gifts. He turned out to be a very astute manager tactically in later years, so he really does understand the game inside out. But was he as good as Platini? Could he have done all the things Platini did for France if England had had this ability to trust a great player in the way the French did? I don't know. No.
Well, it's an impossible, it's a metaphysical speculation.
All we know is that when Argentina tried it with Maradona, it definitely worked. But it took a bloody long time to work with Messi, didn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it did. I think because teams as a whole at international level got better coached
better and there coached, were more
good sides, and it's difficult. I mean, you mentioned earlier Gunter Netzer.
Yeah.
The German side that beat England in 1972.
Yeah.
Netzer was utterly brilliant. I went to the game at Wembley, which actually that was what spelled the end for Alf, wasn't it?
Yeah, because they were overrun. They were just overrun.
And I remember travelling back in the car and saying, we've got no one to match him.
Tony Curry always used to remind me of Netzer physically and in terms of his style. But was he as good?
No, I don't think he was for a minute.
When England had a genuinely world-class player, a player as good as Netzer or almost as good as Platini, well, as good as Platini, i.e. Bobby Charlton, they did win the World Cup.
Can I bring up one of those players? Because, you know, he's a bête noire as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And that's Rodney Marsh.
Ah, yes. I thought that might come up. He lost you the championship, didn't he, Colin?
Not on purpose, John. Not on purpose.
I actually blame Alisson. Because what Alisson wanted was a player to match George Best's pulling power. Mm. Pulling power in the sense of football crowds. Well, nobody can match George Best's pulling power in other areas.
No.
This was something that I felt strongly about. City were 6 points clear just before Easter when it was 2 points for a win. So there were 3 games ahead and it looked like we'd got it absolutely right. Cleverly, he'd bought Wyn Davies to play up front with Francis Lee, and they were a terrific combination. Mm. And Summerby on the right, and Ian Miller, I think he was at that time, on the left. It was a fantastic forward line of four players. And then they bought Marsh. And the whole point about what Alisson had always coached was that the City moved very, very quickly from defence to attack. 3 passes downfield, Lee was in the area with the ball, bang. And Rodney Marsh was like Ginola. Mm. You beat a player, and then you wait for him to recover, then you beat him again, then you beat him again. You don't give it to anybody else. And this slowed the whole thing down. City were a quick counter-attacking side, and they weren't when Rodney Marsh came. The whole team disintegrated, and Marsh seemed to me to symbolise the disintegration of that great 68-72 team. I mean, he just wasn't the right player for that club.
Yet another of Alisson's vanity projects, I'm afraid.
Yes.
But Rodney Marsh was my hero as a footballer. I'm not saying he's the best footballer I ever saw, but if I could have been a footballer, I would have wanted to be Rodney Marsh. You know, dashing, glamorous, entertaining, cheeky, impudent, arrogant. All of those things I love in a footballer. And I later met him. Oh, you should never meet your heroes.
No, I think that's right. I found Rodney Marsh as a person, not a nice person.
Quite suspicious, you know.
Oh, okay.
A little bit sort of prickly and touchy. But that's not his fault. You know, I'm sure there are worse faults. But it's just that the contrast between, you know, the star quality of his football, you know, and the fact that he was just a normal bloke underneath it all. That's not his fault. That's my fault for bigging him up too much. I just loved his attitude on the park. And even at the end, you know, when he linked up with Besti to play for Fulham, he was the master of that sort of footballing comedy, Harlem Globetrotters, if you like.
Yeah.
And George just sort of went along with it. What an entertainer he was.
No, he had this fantastic League Cup final when QPR, who were then in the third division, won. Who was against West Brom?
Arsenal.
That's right, in 67.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mark Lazarus and Rodney Marsh were triumphant that day.
Mm.
But, you know, you remember odd moments. And at the end of the season, where he lost us the championship, in inverted commas, we played Derby County on the last match of the season, and Derby County had already won the championship. And we hammered them. It was a 2-0 hammering, and Rodney Marsh scored a most fantastic goal. And that is kind of my point. He did things that were not relevant. I mean, he did it when it didn't count. You've got to do it at the height of battle. That's when you want your flair players to perform. And that was not what Rodney Marsh did.
Mm.
Am I being unfair, John?
Yeah, I love your description. We hammered them 2-0.
Yeah, well, that's exactly how it was. People who were there will say that's exactly the right phrase.
The fan. Yeah, I think there are players. If you're talking about cricketers, they're flat track bullies, aren't
yes,
they?
Yes, correct.
In that sense, Graham Hick being probably the greatest example of that. And there are players who get important runs when you need them. I always regarded Vardy as a player who scored a goal when you need them. He didn't get that many hat-tricks. But when we won 1-0, it was inevitably Vardy who did it. Danny Rodney Marsh did that a lot. You would win 6-1 and he was brilliant. This entertainment bit and the desire to entertain. Yeah, Frank did have that, Frank Worthington. There were others who had that.
Yes.
There was the guy who played for Reading called Robin Friday.
Yeah.
He was also apparently a brilliant player. There's a book written about him. He had, again, all sorts of personal issues and faded away into obscurity. Alan Hudson, yeah, became rather a sad character after he retired, didn't he?
And well, it wasn't injury at the root of his problems, because he moved to Stoke City, where he loved Tony Warrington. Warrington gave him a freedom that he hadn't felt at Chelsea. And then he went to Arsenal, but he kept moving around. And this is the thing about those flair players, is they don't stay long enough in a place to have the impact that you wish they had. And I bring up, I want to ask Paddy particularly about one player. We all remember the 1971 Cup final for the winning goal by Charlie George and lying on his back at the moment when the ball goes in. That's the winning goal that gives Arsenal the double. He'd come out of the North Bank.
Yes.
He was a local lad.
Yeah.
He had everything about him at that time to be an Arsenal hero for the next 15 years. Didn't happen. Why not?
Well, I don't know enough about Charlie George. I don't know enough about his character, except that I think he was, like, as you mentioned with Frank, you know, a little bit lacking in that determination to be the best. Because he was very, very good, because it had come easy to him early in life, I think he felt, you know, I've done well enough. I've done fine. I'm a legend, you know. I don't need to prove myself the best. I don't think either that I'd be too critical about that. I don't think entertainers have a responsibility to prove to us that they're the all-time great. I never liked this when it was levelled at Matthew Letizia. I would much rather he entertained the people of Southampton for 15 years, as he so richly did, than somehow push his ability to the limit and get more England caps. And I had a feeling that that may have been the case with Charlie George, you know. We keep talking about, you know, people not reaching their potential. And the maverick that we've maybe not touched on enough, who did, who made history. You described him as the great catalyst, Colin. Eric Cantona.
Yes.
Now, nobody's ever going to say, what did he do with his career? Even though it was a short one at Manchester United. Well, what he did with his career was score a goal every other game for France and transform the fortunes of Manchester United. I mean, it's a moot point about whether Alex Ferguson or Eric Cantona changed the fortunes of Manchester United. The truth is, both did.
But it makes the point that Ferguson was the right manager. Well, Ferguson spotted Cantona.
Ferguson not only had Cantona spotted for him by Gerard Houllier, who asked him to take him on and told him, trust me, Eric will not let you down. And of course, Ferguson knew Houllier well enough to know that this was worth a punt. And you've got to give Ferguson a lot of credit for it, because he harnessed this hitherto maverick and made him one of the most practical players in the country, a player who not only could hold the ball up and make a forward line cogent where it hadn't been before, with all due respect to Hughes, McClare, very, very good players themselves, but nothing like the same ability to knit a team as Cantona had. And he made him do that over a prolonged period. Somebody pointed out recently that it was only the season when he was suspended for kicking the Crystal Palace fan. That was the only season when they didn't win the league during his career there. So what was the definition? Unorthodox or independent-minded person? Well, Cantona was always will be an independent-minded person. He qualifies on that. But at Manchester United, was he unorthodox? No, I think he was ultra-practical. And you've got to credit both him and Ferguson for that.
That's the way of getting the flair players into the heart of the team.
As Alf Ramsey did with Bobby Charlton.
Yes, and when that works, that's great. But the other players, those other five that I mentioned, that never happened. Was it because they were intrinsically incapable of doing what Cantona did for United, or did they not have the Ferguson character who managed to get that out of them? I mean, they all got bought for large sums of money at some point. Their flair was recognised. You know, Tony Curry went, I thought, rather oddly from Sheffield United to Leeds. I know it's down the road. But did he actually do anything at Leeds?
Yeah, he did. He was they were a good side at that point under Jimmy Armfield. There's a name we haven't mentioned about Mavericks, and that's Derek Dugan. Derek Dugan did move around.
Oh, that's right.
Derek Dugan did all sorts of things. He asked for a transfer on the eve of a cup final. He had a haircut that resembled a Native American. He fell out with most managers he was with. He sort of, in the end, settled in Wolverhampton, having been previously at Aston Villa, Blackburn, at Leicester. Then he went to Wolves, and he sort of finished at Wolves, and then he became chairman of Wolves and rescued them. And then it all fell apart, didn't it? They went bust again.
You've missed out the fact that he was one of the first of the great pundits. Do you remember when there was... They used to have people like Dugan, Paddy Creran, Malcolm Allison.
Yes.
I mean, these guys used to batter each other all over the studio.
And I have to add this personal reminiscence, because that was my first job. It wasn't really a job. I was on that 1974 panel in the background. That's when I met Clough for the first time, whom I didn't like, or who didn't like me, or didn't have any time for me. But Dugan and Jack Charlton and Paddy Creran, Dugan in particular, were really nice to this 24-year-old university graduate. That's all I was. Dugan, I have nothing but nice things to say about. He took time. He was exceptionally kind, nice man, and I always wanted him to do well. Yeah. In Leicester's great history, John, we've mentioned Worthington and Weller.
Yeah, they didn't win anything that season.
Well, yeah, but who else would count as a maverick in Leicester's triumphant history?
There was a fellow called Johnny Morris who famously got sent off in the first game I saw.
Oh, he was a maverick.
He also caused trouble at Manchester United.
Matt Busby
when
bombed
he was a
him
member out. Of their title-winning side.
Yep.
And at Derby County.
Yeah.
And latterly at Leicester. Yep. Got the manager sacked.
Yep.
Instead of going off to Saudi Arabia, you know, sides at that point used to have weekend breaks at Scarborough and things like that. And Johnny Morris apparently instigated some form of rebellion, and that got Norman Bullock the sack.
In your position as Leicester City chair in that glorious era, and you had a good relationship with was it Jock Wallace, like the manager?
That was before.
So if you are presented with the possibility of signing a really fine player, somebody who could, if he were harnessed properly, do something positive for your club, but he was a maverick, would you and Jock he's a maverick.
Jock wouldn't have signed any. The nearest Jock got to a maverick was the guy who was my best man, the goalkeeper, Mark Wallington, who would come under the heading of a character.
Yeah.
Jock liked characters, but Jock did not like mavericks.
No.
So for me as a chairman, no, I'd have bottled it. I'd have gone, it's up to you, manager. Yeah. You know, if it goes well, it's definitely up to
that.
You.
I would have gone for, when Paddy's talking about Rodney Marsh, and I'm thinking he's got the number 7 on his back and is in the same team as Alan Oakes.
Yeah.
I know who I'd rather have in my side, and it would be Alan Oakes, even though he only had 1 foot.
Yeah.
He was a wonderful, reliable, consistent, thoroughly dependable player who it was a pleasure to see trotting out in that side. You just knew he would never, ever let you down. He would commit to the cause. Mm. And I don't think these mavericks do. And I'm in favour of romanticism. I'm in favour of flair. Mm. But I think, maverick does seem to me to be a pejorative term in the way we are using it.
Yeah.
Well, take, for example, Riyad Mahrez, probably the best player who ever played for Leicester. I would say that now, in my opinion. In terms of skill, he was a team player.
Mm.
He scored lots of goals himself, but he was never guilty of not passing. One suspects that people like Marsh, Ginola as well, particularly, wingers were particularly prone to this, weren't they? Tommy Hutchinson, who played for Coventry, he liked beating a man once, then beating a man twice. Mahrez was not like that. Is that a later era or is that different character? I think it's different character. You wouldn't describe certainly Mahrez as a maverick.
No,
mavericks wouldn't work under Guardiola.
David Beckham was definitely not a maverick player.
Team
he
player.
Was a team player.
Yeah.
He was almost a player, who was there for set pieces. Mm-hmm. Beckham's great ability was with a dead ball.
Yeah.
Corners, free kicks.
I think he should come on, he'd gone to the NFL and become a place kicker almost. I mean, that was the kind of a player he was. Paddy, in the glorious history of Scottish football, you've mentioned Jim Baxter, but there were plenty of other. It's not just creativity, it's something beyond creativity.
Charlie Nicholas, Alfie Conn.
Yes.
Both players that came down from Scotland.
Yes.
With great big reputations.
Yes.
Individual players, sort of style icons in a way, both of them. And neither of them achieved their potential.
No.
Jim Baxter didn't either, south of the border.
No, that's true. Jim Baxter demonstrated his potential early in his career before the Bacardi and, to a lesser extent, the Coca-Cola that he put in it took its toll. But there were, you know, I mentioned Hughie Gallagher from the early years. I mean, Scotland has produced their share of mavericks, but no more than England, actually.
Not a Scottish character.
No, it's not. You know, I'm thinking of fabulous players, Tony Green from the same era as Hutchison. Tony Green was a very pretty disciplined player who, unfortunately, injury curtailed his career. There was Jimmy Smith, the one who played for Newcastle. He was a flair player with no pace, you know, so he did what he did. But no, I don't think we've produced any more characters than any other.
Well, thinking about that definition again of the maverick, would either of you say that Danny Blanchflower was certainly independent?
Yes, independent-minded, but not unorthodox. He led the team. He coaxed the Tottenham team. You know, I know he played for Aston Villa and Northern Ireland as well, but he. And Barnsley. But he coaxed the team. He led the team. And actually, you remind me, of course, he went on to become briefly manager of Chelsea and of Northern Ireland. But we've completely left out and probably still just about got time to talk about maverick managers. And obviously, none will top Clough as far as that's concerned. Although I think a friend of this podcast, Martin O'Neill, I think he's both unorthodox and especially independent-minded. I think he's brought a little bit of the maverick to modern-day management.
Well, and if you're going down that road, then I'm going to add Malcolm Allison to this.
He wasn't a very good manager, whereas Martin O'Neill was. But Martin O'Neill was.
But he was certainly independent and unorthodox. And some of the stories I got told by the players was he would come up with some nonsensical plan every Monday morning.
Yeah.
And one of them was famously a wheel. He wanted all 10 out players to form a circle, to pass the ball about against each other and to move the wheel up the field until the last person got into the penalty area of the opposition and then scored. Mm-hmm. And Mercer would say to him all the time, which is why he was so good, "I think it's a great idea, Malcolm. Try it in training on Monday morning. If it works, play it in the reserves." By which time, of course, the whole thing had just disappeared without trace. And he'd come up with another one. But that was the kind of maverick kind of manager that you got. And what maverick managers don't do is present orderly reports to boards of directors. I don't know whether that still happens, John, but isn't that what they're supposed to do? There's a sort of hierarchy, and the manager is the link between the board and the players.
I think that's what the director of football is meant to do. There's a sort of theory that managers need to be a wee bit mad, or they actually go mad in the end.
Yes.
Lineker always insists that he never wants to become a manager because he'd seen so many and they go completely mad because their whole existence is in the hands of 11 players out there on the pitch. You watch managers' expressions these days because you've got cameras on them. Some of them play to it. Yeah. Some of them feel they need to it. But the pressures that they're under, and then they stick a microphone under their nose and they're expected to be rational about what has gone on and so on. I don't think a maverick manager would last terribly.
No. Well, Arthur Cox, who everybody listening to this will remember as manager of, I think, Derby, Newcastle, various others.
And he became number two to Kevin Keegan at Main Road.
That's right, he did, yeah. He agreed to an interview when I was a journalist. I said, "You said something really off the wall last." He said, "Yeah, I often do, because the players like it. They love meeting the opposition for a drink after the game and saying, 'You think your guy's mad? You should have heard what our guy said.'"
Arthur Cox, Mark Wallington played for him. Yeah. And I know that Arthur had this theory, and Clough was very much part of this. You've got to maintain their attention span, these players. And over a period, it's very, very difficult. If you keep saying, it's like us on this podcast. If you're still with us, folks, we're still saying the same stuff. We're trying to say it differently and we're trying to make it interesting. But it's difficult, you know. Sometimes you think, good God, am I talking the same rubbish I talked last week? Yes. I found it very much experience managing people. When I had a larger operation, you know what? Greg Dyke gave me this advice. Don't go into the office on Friday. By Friday, they've all fed up with you. Go away, and they'll actually get on better. Now, Clough often didn't appear during the week at all, but they would then turn up on Friday and give this sort of Napoleonic speech, if you like. Martin O'Neill, definitely, and when he was on the podcast, he talked about that too, as how he left John Robertson and Steve Walford to do the work, and he got that from Clough. Clough didn't go out, but would then on Friday suddenly emerge, and I think Arthur Cox, he was definitely out of that. There are other managers who have to be there every day. Is that insecurity? If so, does that make it more difficult to deal with the difficult players? If you're there every day saying the same things, trying to drill in the same messages.
That's what Alisson said when he left City. He did say, I can't say anything else to the players. I've said the same things for 7 years. You have to say that Ferguson and Wenger, and to an extent Guardiola now, are staying a remarkably long period of time at one club. It's a tribute, really, to the fact that they can start again. They can build, you know, like Matt Busby built three teams, how many did Ferguson build? That's the key, is you've got different players. So you sort of can say the same thing to them if you're refreshing the players sufficiently often and still keeping that level of consistent success. That's what I thought made Ferguson and Wenger and now Guardiola so remarkable. Mm.
And if we're talking, as we should do, coming to a close about the Mavericks, we do love them. They're players we remember.
Well, that's all true. Our life.
The tricks they pull off, their swashbuckling attitude. Some of them, it's more down to characters and perhaps a feeling that one or two of them could have achieved more. That there's a nostalgia there. They gain a sort of romantic nostalgia, is another thing this program's all about. This podcast's all about.
Yeah, we'll cling to that. Talking nostalgia. I'm not going to give that up.
No, I think the romance is what unites us all with our listeners to the podcast. I'm sure they feel the same way. And the Mavericks certainly contribute to that. So actually, I'm about to stand on my head, having been dismissive and poo-pooed the Mavericks because they never win anything. And you wouldn't want one in the side because it destroys the team. I'm actually saying, you're absolutely right, John and Paddy, that these are the people we remember. And when we look back on our football lives with pleasure, it's those sorts of people and the goals they score and the things they did that we remember above all. So thank you, Paddy. Thank you, John. Thank you, as ever, to our indefatigable producer, Paul Kobrak. And this is Colin Schindler saying, if you want to talk to us about the programme and have your own memories of the Mavericks of your team, we'd love to read about them. You can write to us at footballruinmylife@gmail.com. That's footballruinmylife, all one word, @gmail.com. And we will read them. So thanks for listening to this one. I hope you're going to rejoin us next time when this is Colin Schindler saying thank you so much. Cheerio. See you next time. And I did that really badly, so you can put that on to the end of the programme. OK, well, it's the right length. It's the right length, if nothing else.